This episode contains content that may be alarming to some listeners. We advise listener and reader discretion for graphic depictions of death, discussion of mental ill health, and existential struggle. Please check the show notes for a more detailed description and take care of yourself.
It took me around half an hour to just normalize myself. उसके बाद ये भी मैं अपने आप को रिकवर कर ही रहा था कि I've seen a half burned body. मुझे लगा कि मैं भी कोरोना पॉजिटिव हो गया and I'm also going to die. मेरे जबान के मुंह का टेस्ट चला गया. It was just beyond my imagination. वहीं मैं एक पत्रकार से टकरा गया जिनकी माँ की मौत लास्ट कल हो चुकी थी. ऑक्सीजन नहीं मिला उनको.
I remember this conversation I had with a waste picker in Delhi. We talked on video and he was showing me, taking me around the garbage pile that he was going through. And he said, look at all these masks that people have just thrown. Am I not human? Do my children have to get COVID?
We're looking at a state where the citizen has turned into citizen doctor, citizen nurse, citizen hearse driver, citizen ambulance driver. You know, you're looking to Twitter to find beds for hospital patients. It's a bit absurd.
I got a request on Twitter that a 30-year-old, 6 months pregnant woman was struggling to get a bed. And, you know, I reached out to my resources. I reached out to my friends. We started looking up. I started calling hospitals furiously. In fact, I almost started to drive to one to figure out if we can find something. But by the time we actually found something, she was dead.
So welcome to our listeners and welcome, Vikram, to the Stories from a Pandemic podcast. We just heard from journalists Kashif Kakvi, Rohini Mohan and Ishan Tanka and a COVID-19 response volunteer, Tanu Dogra. And we'll hear more from them over the course of this episode. In today's episode, I'm back in conversation with Professor Vikram Patel as we bring you stories of 8 different frontline workers from India. Their accounts highlight just how complex the realities that young frontline workers face are. And we bring you stories of 3 groups of workers: journalists, volunteers, and essential service workers, to give you a window into how they have provided services through the pandemic in roles that are invisible and most often not acknowledged. Most of us are not aware of the risks frontline workers are exposed to, and the unfortunate reality is that today those at the front are often the most vulnerable. My first question for you, Vikram, is could you help our listeners understand the scope of frontline roles and frontline workers that they are playing in this pandemic? And this question is also about going a bit beyond the health and medical professions, and perhaps also touching a bit upon how there is a lack of a consensus and, you know, maybe even a debate on what constitutes a frontline worker.
So first of all, can I just say how moving those accounts are that we've just heard? They also demonstrate to us that our definition of frontline workers is much broader than what oftentimes we are led to believe. For example, that it only reflects doctors and nurses. In fact, frontline workers for me are pretty much any group in the community who have had to directly engage with in-person activities, even while we have been repeatedly told that we should stay at home or there should be a lockdown for our own safety. Frontline workers are essentially those individuals whose work requires them to in fact take risks that the rest of us are able to protect ourselves from. And this could, of course, include everyone from people who are driving public transport to those who are working in funeral homes, to the journalists that you already covered, the volunteers who are moving from one community to the next to help people who are suffering from COVID-related symptoms, and so on. The list is really quite large, but one thing that really unites them all is that they tend to be hidden from public view. They tend to be individuals who are rarely recognized by society, and very often they tend to be people who are at the lowest income level and with the least power in our society.
Thanks, Vikram. Reporters and journalists play a critical role in helping those of us at home know what's happening outside. And this has been even more crucial in a lockdown era when most of us are sheltering in or at home. And being on the field is something that all reporters who we interviewed shared is an essential part of doing their jobs. However, being on the field during the COVID-19 pandemic, especially in the second wave that we've seen in India, has meant putting themselves at risk and potentially their loved ones and families at considerable personal risk. Over the course of this segment, we'll hear not only what journalists are seeing on the ground and the risks they are compelled to take, but also the impacts that these have on them. We'll first hear from Kashif Kakvi, a Bhopal-based journalist, on why, despite the personal risks, he feels being on the field and telling stories right now is more important than ever before.
So I have gone to the graveyard जहाँ पे कब्रें खोदी जा रही थी 15 से 20 कब्रें एडवांस में खोद के रखी जा रही थी and JCBs were digging the holes because जो लोग कब्रें खोद रहे थे उनके हाथ में छाले पड़ गए थे पिछले दो हफ्ते में कब्र खोदते खोदते एक दिन में कम से कम 15 से 20 लोगों को डिस्पोज ऑफ किया जा रहा था एंड हाफ ऑफ देम आर कोविड बॉडीज तो इस तरह की सिचुएशन सब कुछ देखी उसके बाद मैं जब लौटा डेटा लेकर के लौटा तो मुझे अंदाजा ये लगा कि 17 अप्रैल तक मध्य प्रदेश में करीब भोपाल में करीब 1400 बॉडीज कोविड प्रोटोकॉल से डिस्पोज ऑफ की गई जबकि गवर्नमेंट का डेटा कहे कि कुल 50 लोग कोविड से मरे हैं सो व्हेन आई रिपोर्टेड दिस कि ये ऐसा ऐसा हो रहा है एंड देन आई स्टार्टेड अ कैंपेन ऑन ट्विटर आई स्टार्टेड पोस्टिंग डेली रिपोर्ट्स with the government figure and with the crematorium figures. जैसे मेरी ये देखने के बाद टीवी के एक रिपोर्टर गए so he found PR it is true. तो इस तरह की चीजें जब उन्होंने जाकर के खुद से ग्राउंड पे देखी तो NDTV के गए रिपोर्टर गए फिर ABP न्यूज के रिपोर्टर गए फिर यहाँ के लोकल रिपोर्टर्स गए और इट क्रिएटेड चेन ऑफ रिपोर्ट्स नाउ सो ए सिंगल विजिट अनफोल्डेड टू मेनी थिंग्स कि सरकार झूठ बोल रही है And now it has become a daily routine. भोपाल के 3-4 local newspaper लगातार अब वो इस report को कि सरकारी आंकड़ा ये है और crematoriums का कहना ये है. Even the New York Times has covered this story.
Kashif's reporting has played an important role in debunking published figures about COVID deaths. We'll now quickly hear from Ishan Tanka, a Delhi-based photojournalist, on feeling unsafe and what makes him the most anxious about his job.
Unlike many other situations where photographers and reporters are, you know, putting themselves in unsafe situations, this was kind of different because, you know, once you remove yourself from an unsafe situation, you're safe. But in this case, that didn't exist. That luxury didn't exist. You were, in fact, taking back whatever you may have picked up. Because at the end of the day, you are going back to people you love and care for. So I think that distance that we are going to have to create to keep ourselves safe is the biggest challenge for me.
Maintaining this safe distance isn't always a reality for most people, and we'll hear more about situations where that distance is in fact the biggest hindrance for frontline workers. While all of us may worry every day about how to keep safe from this disease, those on the front lines need to worry a lot more. They are exposed to the highest risks and therefore, logically, should receive the most protection, but unfortunately, this doesn't seem to be the case. We now hear from Rohini, a Bangalore-based journalist, on how the stress of managing safety for such an extended period of time has a profound impact on her.
I'm in Karnataka. They approved the journalists are frontline workers and said that vaccines should be available for us, but they're just not available. They've never set up a procedure on how we go about getting one. And mental health, I would say, is... everybody is kind of shot. Their minds are, our minds, I should say, are running at speeds, falling to depths, you know, reaching rage that I think we are not having an outlet for, especially since we are working from home, especially since we are not doing anything else but covering the pandemic, most of us. And also coupled with personal worries, the social interaction or the cultural consumption. These are ways in which we let out our stress. These are not there. And we are usually able to do adda, talk to each other about our work. That is not there because we don't meet each other. And we're only consuming the pain of others and trying to set aside our own worries and our own personal fears or anxieties. And this is obviously not healthy. The new challenge is having to think about myself falling sick. Now I'm as vulnerable as anybody I'm reporting on. Even if I think to myself that I don't care that I fall sick, there is my family. And you know, it's like when somebody tells you, don't fall sick now, fall sick later when there are beds available. I mean, what a farce that is. What a remarkable way in which we have to think, right? So there is that. So for the first time, I think I'm thinking so much about my own safety. As a freelancer, and I think a freelancer from any sector would identify, we are pretty much independent. That is the advantage. The disadvantage is when something goes bad, there's no one to protect you. There is no cushion. There is no extra money. There is no editor or employer who is going to pay for if you fall sick or if you get injured. They're not going to step in, right? Those are not in our contracts. And that is exacerbated now. People say, oh, be careful and wear PPE. And that be careful really frustrates me, you know, and it makes me very angry. This thing of just be careful. What are the concrete ways in which you're helping me be careful? But at the same time, I'm also experiencing the pull of having to report, the more, you know, the social pull of having to do my job.
So could you comment, Vikram, on this notion of safety? And has this notion of safety changed where there are threats to our physical safety, but also to our mental well-being? And for quite a long period of time, it's been, you know, over a year, year and a half now.
What these latest stories remind me of is the notion of trauma. The fact that trauma, which is one of the most well-recognized determinants of mental health, can take many shapes. But at its heart, it's really characterized by the toxic effects of extreme fear, insecurity, uncertainty, helplessness, and profound grief on our minds. And if you listen to these stories, it becomes extremely evident that each of these stories touches on some of these aspects, indeed, perhaps all of these aspects of trauma. If that is the case, then it would not be surprising to conclude that trauma is sweeping across India and particularly affecting frontline workers disproportionately. As millions of stories of suffering, despair, and death here seen firsthand are twinned with profound helplessness as the comfort of a government or an employer who you can rely on and trust has evaporated.
Thanks, Vikram. And interestingly, I mean, you mentioned helplessness, and that's actually what we'll be talking about in this next section. We go back to Delhi-based journalist Ishan about 2 days in the pandemic that he will never forget.
You know, last year I thought no day was going to top the first day that I went out to take pictures. I had actually gone to just buy some eggs and, you know, groceries. But then when I saw what was happening on the road, which was the exodus, we've all termed the migrant exodus, you know, the workers going back home, desperate. And at that point, you know, they shut down all trains, all buses, on all transport. So it was literally on the road. And I came back home, I picked up the camera, I went back out because honestly, I wouldn't have believed it if I hadn't seen it myself. It was a sight from history books. That was a day which will be difficult to forget. Or at least I thought that until, you know, last week, when it's a different kind of pain that you're seeing. There's definitely a lot more death. I actually went to take some pictures at Indirapuram. There's a Gurdwara where they've set up an oxygen langar, free oxygen. After a little while, the volunteers over there have no choice but to say, listen, you've got to take this person away somewhere else to a hospital because, you know, he's gonna die right now otherwise. And as someone who's standing there and sort of witnessing this, I'm not as invested in that particular moment because it's not my family. But I can almost feel the panic sort of taking over in me. because I know what's coming next. You're going to be in a car, you're going to have an unconscious father, mother, brother, sister, friend, and you don't know where to go. You know, you're literally on the road. And I don't, I mean, you want to do something, but you have no options to even, you don't even have a single idea that you can give, hey, that, you know, go in that direction.
This feeling of helplessness that you just mentioned seems to resonate with all of the people that we interviewed for this episode. And this feeling was associated with both the situation unraveling around them and their inability to help. We go back to Rohini, who tells us how she has been managing to do her job through this.
You know, strangely, in the first wave, I felt extremely, I was very affected by what was going on. But I felt, because of my privilege, and I was able to extend some of that privilege in terms of helping others, in terms of food and all of that. But in the second wave, I feel like I can't do anything. You know, feeding people, that's not the concern right now. Everything feels absolutely like it's crashing around me. So I have not felt as comfortable in my job or in my personal life and the people falling sick so close to you. It has felt, every day that I don't fall sick has felt like luck, or a guilty privilege.
This guilt and helplessness are manifest in different ways when journalists are on the ground telling stories.
Just day before yesterday, actually, last week I was working on a story on COVID orphans, and I was having to reach out to families that recently bereaved, especially children who have lost their parents. And I felt so ashamed of my job. I'm used to in the sense I know how to interview people who are grieving and people who have just witnessed or experienced trauma, because I know how to do it face to face. I know what non-verbal cues to do, when to shut up and when to just observe, when not to ask questions, when to just hold someone's hand and be quiet. But, you know, when I have to text someone and ask them, I want to talk to them 8 days after they've lost their parents, it just felt, at the same time, I have a deadline. I also want to tell this story because it's important. It was so, I felt quite small, and I felt really like my job was making me do things that were so insensitive.
What's happening that... It's not that you don't want to give dignity to people. It's that there is no dignity being given to people. You have 3 days of waiting to get a slot to cremate your dead. It's not like you have places to keep your dead. So where's the dignity? You know. So what? I really don't know how to angle my camera to not seem exploitative. Like, it's like wherever you point, just turn. Any picture seems exploitative, quite honestly. I am sort of questioning how much more of because from what every expert is saying, this is going to go on for some time. So yeah. if it's going to be devastation, which is sort of moving around geographically, are we going to be doing as reporters and photographers and documenters, is it the same thing we're going to be shooting for the next, I don't know, 6 months, 8 months? What does that do, and what will that do to both the image makers and the viewers?
As Ashan shared, the pandemic in India has taken away even more dignity from people, especially in their darkest hour. I'd like to turn his question over to you, Vikram. We've heard from Kashif, Ishan, and Rohini on the challenges of not only what they have seen, but also the stresses of gathering and telling these very difficult stories. And in the short to medium term, considering, as Ishan points out, that this probably isn't going to end very soon, what impacts do you predict that this is having on journalists or on people telling these stories and on the people who are watching or reading this news and this information?
Uh, Earlier, I have made some remarks about some of the ingredients about the second wave of this pandemic that can help us understand why trauma has become very widespread, especially for frontline workers. What we've just heard in these latest accounts is another really critical factor, and that is the moral dilemma of the choices that one is faced with, especially when the choices are both unpleasant, lacking dignity, and inhuman. I thought the comment in particular about whether to take an image which is not exploitative, but at the same time, which really does what a journalist is seeking to do, to tell the story, the truthful story. That kind of moral dilemma I've also seen at many different levels during this second pandemic. For example, in my own networks, the question about where a oxygen concentrator should be kept when more than one person actually needed it. These are the sort of horrible decisions no human being is ever prepared for and wants to actually make. This is when we rely on a system. And of course, it is that system that has disintegrated in front of our eyes. It wouldn't surprise me at all that if we had to think of this widespread trauma in our society, that we will see an increase in distress across the population, and that this will inevitably fuel an increase in clinically significant mental health problems. But I would really caution for us to sort of translate that into saying that everyone needs a therapist. I think we really do need to see this increase in distress as part of a normative response of the human mind to an unprecedented and extraordinary set of stressors that we have never experienced in our lives before. That said, of course, because there will be individuals who will develop more significant mental health problems, we also have to attend to how those individuals can be helped towards recovery.
We now move to the second segment of this episode, hearing from food delivery agents who are classified as essential workers. In many states, these workers have been instrumental in ensuring social distancing, working from home, and a sense of normalcy for most of us during the lockdown. We talked to three employees from I Say Organic, a social enterprise offering home delivery of groceries through the lockdowns. We heard earlier in this episode from journalist Rohini, who talked with a waste picker, also an essential worker, who was not even provided with basic protective measures like a pair of gloves or a mask. These essential workers provide indispensable services. Since the lockdown last year, the media has actively covered stories of many companies, large and small, where workers claim they received no minimum guarantee of work or any payout if they were laid off. Workers were also required to produce e-passes, failing which there have been many incidents of brutal police checks and violence. First, we hear from Kiran, a customer service agent at I Say Organic, who tells us how COVID is different this year as compared with last year. She says in the second wave, every second house was COVID positive. And she even tells us how customers were voicing their frustrations at the service when they needed to organize safe deliveries. She also tells us how worrying it is knowing that your colleagues are constantly being exposed to COVID.
जब 20 में कोविड आया और 2021 में आया काफी डिफरेंस था कोविड का कि ये था कि पहले मोस्टली केसेस थे इस टाइम पे ये कि हर मतलब सेकंड हाउस में या सेकंड मतलब पर्सन को पॉजिटिव निकल रहा है क्योंकि हमारे मोस्टली क्लाइंट थे जो हम कॉल पे बात कर रहे होते हैं तो कस्टमर सडनली मुझे कहता है हाय किरण यार मुझे ना कोविड हो गया है तो थोड़ा सा डिलीवरी बॉय को बोल देना वो अपना ऑर्डर रख के चले जाएगा मैं पेमेंट कर दूंगी ऐसे हमें बोलता है तो हम भी शौक होते हैं कि हमारे फ्रेंड को कोविड है एकदम से माइंड इतना हो जाता है दो मिनट के लिए कि हमारा ये क्लाइंट को भी कोविड हो गया एंड देन तीन कॉल्स के बाद फिर होता है कि एक और क्लाइंट बोलता है कि हाँ यार मुझे कोविड हो गया तो आपने डिलीवरी बॉय को बोलना कि ठीक से रख दे कि और मतलब इवन की शॉर्ट भी होते हैं कुछ कस्टमर की यार आप लोग इतना वो कर रहे हो हमें हैसल कर रहे हो ये कर रहे हो कि मतलब आप इतनी कॉल्स कर रहे हो क्योंकि हमारा वो प्रायोरिटी के डिलीवर करने से पहले हमें कॉल करते ही है मैं कोविड पॉजिटिव हूँ मतलब हम ही उनकी जितना स्ट्रेस उनको होता है उस कॉल पे उससे ज्यादा आपका कॉल डिस्कनेक्ट करने के बाद हमें बढ़ जाता है मेंटली कि यार उनको कोविड है, हमारे डिलीवरी बॉय जा रहे हैं, उनसे हम भी कहीं ना कहीं हो रहे हैं कि हमें ये प्रॉब्लम तो ना हो जाए.
Orders are then processed by the warehouse team, and we now hear from Sandeep in the warehouse on the struggles faced when he was training his delivery agents to visit homes with COVID positive individuals.
स्टार्टिंग में तो बहुत दिक्कत लग रही थी, क्योंकि लड़कों को भी समझाना बहुत बहुत ही मुश्किल हो रही थी, कि उनको समझाना कि आप किसी कस्टमर के घर जा रहे हैं तो कस्टमर ने पहले से बता रखा है कि कोविड मैं कोविड पॉजिटिव हूं, तो उनके यहाँ पे कैसे जाओगे या फिर आप क्या करोगे. तो उनको भी डर लगता है कि नहीं, मैं अगर उनके गेट पे भी रख के आऊंगा या उनकी कोई चीज टच करके आ गया तो वो है. बट उसके बाद में जब उनको प्रॉपर तरीके से समझाया गया, हिम्मत बनाई गई कि आप जाएंगे तो ग्लव्स आपने लगा रखे होंगे तो उसका आपके हाथों में कुछ नहीं होगा, बाहर निकलने के बाद में आप डस्टबिन गाड़ी में रख रखा है तो वो ग्लव्स फेंक दीजिए या सैनिटाइज कीजिए. तो नॉर्मली समझाने में टाइम तो दिमाग को वो करने में टाइम लगा, बट सबके दिमाग में ये चीज आ गई कि जितना इससे डरेंगे या फिर माइंड में हमारे थिंकिंग रहेगी कि नहीं हो सकता है तो उतना ही ज्यादा बीमार होने के. पूरे कोविड के टाइम में हम सबसे बड़ी प्रॉब्लम जो हम लोगों के लिए रही वो प्रॉपर अपने स्टाफ वगैरह के लिए जो ट्रांसपोर्ट वगैरह अरेंज कराना था वो, क्योंकि पब्लिक ट्रांसपोर्ट में कितनी भी सेफ्टी के साथ में अगर ये लोग आते तो किसी न किसी के टच में आ जाती, क्योंकि आजकल के टाइम में बहुत से लोग ऐसे हैं जो सिर्फ अपना वही पैसा कमाने के लिए बोलिए या फिर रोजगार चलाने के लिए अगर थोड़े बहुत उनके अंदर सिम्टम्स भी हैं फिर भी घूम रहे हैं. इसके लिए सबसे मेन हमें सबसे ज्यादा तो अपने पूरे स्टाफ के लिए पर्सनल जो व्हीकल वगैरह थी वो उपलब्ध करानी पड़ी. सेकेंड चीज जो हमारे कस्टमर वगैरह थे उनसे स्पेशली रिक्वेस्ट करनी पड़ी कि मैम आपको अगर जरा सी भी कोई प्रॉब्लम है या फिर आप कोविड पेशेंट हैं तो हमें बता दीजिए, पहले से इन्फॉर्म कर दीजिए.
Considering how difficult even getting to work can be, it certainly makes you wonder about how easy we are making it for our essential workers. Sandeep also tells us that he needed to live in isolation to keep his own family safe.
So, इससे भी ज़्यादा हम लोगों ने ध्यान रखा था कि जैसे बिल्कुल ही अलग ही रूम ऊपर सेट कर लिया था, वहाँ पे खाना वगैरह भी बनाना अपने हाथ से ही था, सारी चीजें अपने हाथ से ही कर रहे थे, तो उस समय तो बिल्कुल फैमिली के पास भी नहीं जा रहे थे. अभी कुछ चीजें तो ऐसी चेंज हुई है कि जैसे हम ऑफिस से जाने के बाद में सीधे अपने जैसे नॉर्मली जो भी फ्रेश होना है उसके बाद में घर में बच्चों के साथ सबके साथ बैठ जाते हैं. अब क्या है कि हमने नॉर्मल रूटीन बना रखा है कि अपना सारा नहाने वगैरह का सारा सेटअप ऊपर छत पे कर रखा है, यानी यहाँ से ऑफिस से जाने के बाद हम सीढ़ियों से सीधे छत पे चले जाते हैं. जो भी अपनी ड्रेस है, कपड़े जूते वगैरह सारा खुद ही अपने हाथ से ही धोना और उनको छत पे ही बिल्कुल वो कर देना, फिर घंटे या दो घंटे का बिल्कुल रेस्ट करना, उसके बाद में बच्चों से बिल्कुल दूर बैठना, यानी कि घर में जा रहे हैं बट एक तरीके से नॉर्मली गेस्ट की तरह उनके साथ में अभी जो व्यवहार कर रहे हैं वो ऐसे बिल्कुल है.
It seems that Sandeep's efforts have paid off and he has not tested positive for COVID yet. His colleague Shailendra, who works with deliveries, wasn't so lucky last year. For Shailendra, who tested positive, the risks were not only personal but also social. We now hear his experience about coping with the negative reactions of his neighbors.
जैसे पिछले साल था तो उसमें उस टाइम मैं खुद पॉजिटिव ड्यूटी के टाइम पे ही मैं पॉजिटिव हो गया था. कहाँ से हुआ कैसे हुआ मुझे पता नहीं, पूरी हमारे पूरी कंपनी को टेस्टिंग हुई, किसी को कुछ नहीं निकला. मैं भी मुझे कोई दिक्कत नहीं थी लेकिन उन्होंने बोल दिया पॉजिटिव. मुझे यकीन खुद नहीं हुआ. मैं राधा स्वामी सत्संग में 14 दिन वहाँ रह के आऊँ, 3 दिन घर पे था, वहाँ से आने बाद 17-18 दिन टोटली था. मुझे ना फीवर था, ना कमर में दर्द था, ना सर्दी खांसी जुकाम, इन दोनों कुछ नहीं था. लेकिन जो मेरे बच्चों के साथ, मेरी फैमिली के साथ, हमारे पड़ोसी हैं, हमारे रिश्तेदार हैं, जो भी हैं, उन्होंने ऐसा बिहेव किया मैम, मतलब उससे मैं हिल गया. मतलब कोविड-19 पहले मैंने काम करा, अभी मैं काम कर रहा हूँ, मुझे अपने आप से डर नहीं. लेकिन जो लोगों का व्यवहार था जो कि ऐसा नहीं होना चाहिए, बहुत ही गंदा था. और बच्चों से मतलब छोटे बच्चे, अभी बड़ी लड़की 6 साल की है, छोटी लड़की 4 साल की है, लड़का अभी 8-9 महीने का है, तो लोग बच्चों को अपने घर से भगाना, रास्ते बंद कर देना, यहाँ से नहीं जाना, तुम्हारे पापा ऐसे हैं, तुम्हारे पापा वैसे हैं, दुर्व्यवहार था, बहुत गंदा लगा, बहुत बुरा लगा मैम. जो हमारे रिलेशन में थे उन्होंने भी मदद नहीं करा. तो ये मैम कह रहा हूँ कि अपने लाइफ में इंसान को इतना अपने आप से इतना मजबूत हरदम रखना चाहिए ताकि कोई समस्या अगर आए हम किसी पर निर्भर ना रहे कि हमारा कोई आगे मदद करेगा.
Shailendra's story is heartbreaking and is sadly becoming a common one of people who test COVID positive and have been stigmatized in their communities. Vikram, how do we build more empathy and understanding for those on the front line? And an understanding that values their work, the personal risks to their health and lives to keep others safe, just to deliver essential services that keep the rest of our homes and our lives functioning on a day-to-day basis.
These are such harrowing stories. Here you hear accounts of people who are doing essential jobs that none of us or the majority of us wouldn't venture to do at a time like this. And not only putting their own lives at risk, but the lives of their families, but on top of that, to heap insult on injury, actually facing stigma and discrimination from their neighbors. Well, first of all, you know, I think the most important thing we can do as a society is to begin by acknowledging that frontline workers are not just doctors and nurses in hospitals. I think it's important to acknowledge that doctors and nurses have seen death on an epic scale, but actually through all the stories you've heard today of what we really understand now is that frontline workers are a much more diverse group of individuals with very different experiences. And the example of the person who comes and delivers your pizza is such a great example. How much do we think of that individual as a frontline worker? So just simply acknowledging and accepting that people who are around, up and around in our communities doing in-person activities that we don't do are all frontline workers. Secondly, I believe very strongly that we need an informational campaign that is attached to this to let people understand the truth about this infection. One of the greatest crises I think we face right now isn't just the pandemic, but the infodemic, or perhaps more importantly, the lack of trusted, accurate information. And I think in that context, it isn't surprising actually that people are fearful. So I wouldn't immediately put the blame on people's neighbors, for example. I think they're just reacting with fear that is completely explicable given the fact that we don't get trusted, accurate information from the sources that historically we relied on. For example, the leadership of the medical establishment in the government. I think, acknowledging also needs to go more beyond just simply accepting these individuals, the roles that they play, but also offering them monetary incentives that recognize that they're in fact doing jobs that are high risk and are essential. They're not just, doing these jobs because they enjoy going out into the community and taking risks, but because, in fact, they have to do so. And so providing monetary incentives is critically important as well. Finally, offering support in terms of both peer support, but also more professional support for those individuals who are experiencing significant mental health difficulties would be one more strategy that I would strongly advocate for.
You know, a lot of people have been very kind to me in my recovery, which is largely what inspired me to take this up. Because I remember during my time, I was already struggling to get basic medication in a sense onto, you know, Instagram and Twitter, and, you know, cases were picking up. My feed was full with people basically scratching every edge to find, you know, COVID related resources. It picked up really naturally for me. I started retweeting them and, you know, attending those queries. And because the helplessness was so jarring, I have to admit, you know, that was also one of the points that really pushed me to help them. In fact, my job, which is as a full-time book publicist, I actually took a back seat. I was focusing day in and day out. My clear focus was on these requests. In fact, incidentally, it was also the time of my recovery, and I do feel now that in hindsight that, you know, I think I let that recovery slip through the cracks because I was so deep into this work. There were days that I would forget to eat. There were days that I would forget to sleep, and which, of course, now has taken a toll on my body. As days went on, they averaged up to 30 to 40 requests a day. In fact, I still have requests in my others folder that I haven't been able to tackle because I was just so overwhelmed. You know, the thing with requests is that the process is so complicated because there are different channels involved. So there would be the patient's family member, there would be 10 different vendors that I would be talking to, there'd be three other, you know, friends who'd be also coordinating that. So essentially, you know, all of us had to have that skill of negotiation at that period. These are grieving families, so we had to be at our best foot, you know. We had to really calm them, calm ourselves. Because it was so dynamic, there wasn't really a structure set, besides that I knew that, okay, I will wake up at 8 a.m. or 7 a.m. to do an SOS call.
That was Tanu Dogra from Delhi. She is a book publicist, and Tanu recovered from COVID-19 herself at the end of March earlier this year. The support and the kindness that she received from her friends inspired her to become a COVID-19 response volunteer. Her volunteering journey began with the simple act of sharing and amplifying the needs of other COVID patients on social media. And at the beginning of this episode, we heard Tanu tell us about trying to assist a 30-year-old pregnant woman who died because she wasn't able to get a hospital bed. Since April this year, with hospitals and clinics around the country facing a shortage of essential supplies, including beds, oxygen, drugs, vaccines, and COVID-19 tests, it is citizens like Tanu and civil society groups that have stepped forward. In April and May, volunteer groups sprung up all over the country, identifying available hospital beds, oxygen supplies, and sharing these with families in need. And I'm sure that this is something that many of our listeners can relate to, as they were probably doing this themselves. Individuals and groups, though highly motivated, were not equipped to step in and solve such a large-scale humanitarian crisis that was and is still unfolding. We'll now hear from Likla, who works with Ya'ol, a Manipur-based nonprofit working with LGBTI youth and young people with HIV on their health and well-being. Likla is also a volunteer with Manipur's COVID response team, which is a group of 7 different organizations. Let's hear about one of the most challenging cases Likla was supporting and how terrified she felt.
You know, it's always challenging, you know, every time you are not able to find the requirements of SOS request. And if I have to recall one, there was this case of a woman. She had a 9-month-old infant with her, and it was an emergency case. They were staying in a COVID care center, and due to her condition, she had to be shifted to the hospital. So I got in touch with one of the doctors of the hospital, and she told us to get a referral from the center and send her to the hospital. So we prepared everything, we got everything done, and when the patient reached the hospital, the patient's family couldn't find any person, any authority who could, you know, help them get through the admission process. And I tried calling the doctor again, but she didn't pick up. I called her n number of times and she was not picking up. Later I found out that she was on COVID duty. So things had become so uncertain whether she would get admitted or not, and the patient's family were literally panicking. I was panicking and I felt so helpless because I was in my room and all I could do was contacting people and coordinating. So the problem here is that, you know, there are no proper line of contacts, and the contacts that we have are the personal numbers of the doctors that are being circulated. So like, since these are not helpline numbers, it's not guaranteed that, you know, anytime you called, it will be picked up. So I tried a few other numbers and they were not reachable. They were not peaking. And fortunately, the medical superintendent of the hospital picked my call, and with the help of him, she finally got a bed in the hospital. See, the situation like this is very difficult and very challenging. And, you know, the patient had to wait for hours in the ambulance. And that this was really terrifying, and I still wonder how things would have turned out if my call was not picked up, if nobody picked up my call that night. I still wonder how disaster it would have been and how risky it would have been for the patient especially.
The accounts of many volunteers, including Likla, echo the same feelings of panic, worry, and even feeling responsible when patients, including those they don't know and have never met, don't survive. Another important fact being overlooked is that frontline workers of all kinds are people too, with families and loved ones who are affected by COVID-19 too, and coping with crises at home. Let's hear from Tanu again on her experiences helping her uncle, who was in need of critical care, whilst she was also supporting strangers, many of whom she will probably never meet or see face to face. We asked her how she copes, and here is what Tanu had to say.
But what is interesting is that, you know, my biggest support system has been my friends. You know, they've been absolutely fantastic. And I don't think that, you know, I've garnered new friendships during this time, you know, through Twitter and Instagram. And it's incredibly encouraging, you know, to have these friends, your peers, even acquaintances, you know, reach out to you to keep a check on you, engage you in conversations. Frankly, I'm operating on hope. I'm operating on compassion. And I really hope that this crisis will destigmatize mental health in our country because, it is essential. It is non-negotiable. And counseling definitely needs to be made free and mandatory for all.
First, how do people begin to recover from what they have seen or what they have experienced? Much of which has been very traumatizing at an individual level and also at a collective one.
So first of all, you know, let us acknowledge that it would be adding even further burden on people who are risking their lives to do the jobs that we've just heard about by asking them also to take care of themselves without any scaffolding or support. This is where I think society more generally, even if the government has failed on all accounts, I think this is where civil society has to step in and create the necessary supports to make sure that frontline workers are protecting themselves, both from the infection, their loved ones from the infection, but also being able to conduct their work while keeping their mental health in a reasonable shape. I think, as I mentioned earlier, you know, I really see what we witnessed in these last few months as a humanitarian crisis, really. It's perhaps the biggest humanitarian crisis that has hit India since our independence. And in that context, if I look at the kinds of responses that we should be supporting, these are responses that come in the same vein as what you'd see in a humanitarian context. For example, prioritizing basic needs, in particular safety from the infections, equipping people with the necessary tools to protect themselves, but also for their families, support for their families in the same way. For many of the more low-income frontline workers, ensuring that they have adequate access to food and shelter, and assuring that these are individuals and their families who will be given a priority should they ever need life-saving interventions. Of course, we can disseminate promoting self-care strategies for one's mental health. I would suggest that that's something we should do for everyone in the population. But I wouldn't suggest that that should be the only thing that we should invest in for frontline workers. Similarly, obviously, I would also call for the supporting of specific help for mental health interventions for frontline workers, acknowledging that they are disproportionately affected by what is happening in the pandemic. I wanted to say one more thing. You know, I think, and here I speak not just to frontline workers, but to the broader communities in which these workers are find themselves. I think we must find a place to park our anger and rage. I believe that this is potentially one of the most dominant emotions that many people are experiencing. We've heard snippets of that in people's accounts. But I also know in my own heart and talking to many people around me that this is a very dominant emotion. But I also know that it's also a very destructive emotion. I think what we need to do is to try and find ways to channel this anger, as justified as it might be, and search for the compassion that lurks beneath it, and support in any way, in any possible way. There are many different ways. The efforts of the thousands of frontline workers and civil society organizations who are trying to stem the tide of suffering and death in the second wave. The outpouring of community action that we've already heard about and we've seen happen across the country, I think is a soothing balm for the anxiety that many of us are experiencing as we fear that the state that we relied on seems to have collapsed around us. It is civil society, I think, that has come out as perhaps the most important protector of both dignity and the rights of people to safety and to good health in these last few months.
Thanks, Vikram. We now hear two concluding thoughts from Ishan and Rohini about their hopes for the future.
If you look at what's happened in the last year and a half, the even if we just start with the term social distancing, you know, in a country like India, it's a loaded term. We already have all kinds of ways of distancing between people, whether it's caste or class. So we need to sort of look at this situation and see what our problems have been, which is pretty evident. We've been focused, our governments have been focused on, you know, dividing us more or less. Masjids and temples are more important than hospitals. Once we've been through this really low phase of seeing the collapse, seeing that, you know, what years of neglect, and while you're feeding other industry or you're buying arms or whatever, you're not making hospitals, you're not making better medical colleges and et cetera, what that has done. So I think maybe that's the hopeful thing, that people are going to realize that, and there's going to be a lot more demanded of our administrators, our government.
The hope is that people are not taking some of the disadvantages that have been imposed on them lightly. People are getting angry, finally. People are getting upset. People are demanding that things change. Unfortunately, it is in the midst of great, unbearable grief. But there is a loud call for things to change, at least in the health sector, for things to change in terms of governance. Ask people what they want, see what they're asking, listen carefully and do that job. So I see I see a lot of hope in that. People are not switching off from asking for accountability. And this is something that I've always been frustrated by, you know, from most people saying that why should we care? But now we're all together in the depths of horror. And at least some people, many people are now asking for accountability. The other thing of hope is just how people care for each other. I mean, the beauty of seeing absolute strangers being so kind to each other and just trying to help each other survive, whether it is somebody who is driving an ambulance every day to carry dead bodies to the crematorium, whether it is somebody who is rushing about with an oxygen cylinder to refill it and give it to another family, or a homemaker who's sitting and cooking meals based on customizing it according to the patients that she's giving to different hospitals, or just people checking on each other, importance of friends. And that's all we have right now, because everyone's sort of lost hope in the great systems and we only have each other. But that is also what is coming in handy right now. If anyone has survived, it is actually because people are going out of their way to help each other, including those who are doctors and nurses and people who are working on the street, people who are regular students. Everyone is just helping each other, absolute strangers that are opening their hearts out and going, spending day and night helping each other. That is so beautiful, and that is the really the only way we are coming out of this pandemic. How it will look when we do come out of the pandemic, I have no idea. Sometimes I think it'll just be like this never happened. It'll just be like we'll go back to how it always was. But going by how whenever I see an old movie or a photograph that is set in a different time and I get panicky about no one wearing masks in a crowd, I think something has shifted in my brain and most of us, where I think we are going to worry about certain things. I wish some of the source problems like climate change and our destruction of wildlife, some of this we will never forget, and we will work on it so that we are not in this position again. I hope there will be investment, much, much more investment in public healthcare. I hope we will care for facts and truth as we do today and not go back to rhetoric and religion and identity-based politics. And I really hope that we will not forget what has been really important in this last year, that is that actually we can see inequality, privilege, underprivilege quite clearly. we know who is privileged, we feel it, and we shouldn't forget that.
My last question is one that I think is on many of our minds, which is one that Rohini just raised. How do you think we will look when we emerge from this pandemic? And do you think that something fundamental has shifted inside of us?
Long-term recovery of the collective trauma that we are seeing across the country will need resolution of the pent-up rage that is burning a hole in our souls. We've heard so much of that in some of the stories in this podcast. In due course, I think what we're going to need is some kind of equivalent of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. You know, the ones that we've heard about that have served to heal the collective traumas of events that affected entire populations, such as apartheid in South Africa. Such an independent commission, in my mind, would help document the facts behind the tragedy that has unfolded across India. It's not just about blaming people. It's really about offering a path towards restorative justice to heal a deeply wounded nation. You know, recently, the Delhi High Court issued an order to the central government to ensure the supply of oxygen. And I was puzzled by the statement of the judge when he said, as it stands, we all know that this country is run by God. I absolutely hope and pray that that is not what we do after this second wave has passed. This is not a divine act. What we must do is that get an actual and factual account of why this apocalypse happened. The people of this country are entitled to this because we need this honest account to put to rest our troubled minds, to rebuild trust in our nation, and to be much better prepared for the next pandemic. And to the second point, I hear repeatedly accounts of how acts of kindness, acts of compassion are such powerful ways to soothe the anxiety, the despair, and the anger that we're experiencing. I'm not surprised because there is a very rich body of science that has shown repeatedly that when we reach out to others, when we do what some of us call charity, when we are compassionate to others who are in a more difficult situation than ourselves, even if we think we're helping them, actually what we're doing more than anything else is helping ourselves. Because we as human beings are fundamentally social animals. And in reaching out and making connections with others, including complete strangers, what we're building is a social safety net for our own well-being.
Thank you, Vikram, for your insights today. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in. Today, we heard experiences from different frontline workers during the second COVID-19 wave in India and discussed how these experiences can inform and prepare our future humanitarian response to COVID-19 in India, while also addressing the mental health fallout of the second wave and its response. If you or someone you know is in need of mental health support, you can visit Sangat's COVID-19 Wellbeing Center on www.sangath.in for helplines and community support options. You can also visit the description box of this episode for more links to resources. Stories from a Pandemic is supported by the Wellcome Trust as part of our Manmela project. And thanks to our studio engineer Ishan Gandhi and producer Faith Gonzalez for today's episode.